science, technology, society, our lives, philosophy, and religion. This is Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. The space industry is truly a global pursuit. As various countries develop their own space programs, their varying cultures lead to different approaches and different perspectives. Today, our guest is Dr. Susmita Mohanty. Voted as Financial Times 25 Indians to Watch in 2012, Susmita is an entrepreneur and has started businesses in three different countries. These businesses incorporate aerospace, architecture, data, machine learning, and artificial intelligence. Her latest venture is Earth to Orbit, India's first private space startup. With it, she hopes to improve India's space industry and encourage private companies as well as government agencies to participate. So welcome to the podcast, Susmita.
Thanks, Elizabeth, for having me.
Many of our listeners may not be very familiar with the space program in India. So can you briefly tell us a little bit about its history?
Yeah, absolutely. The Indian space program is one of the oldest space programs in the world and a very accomplished one. It started in the late 60s, early 70s, when India launched its first experimental rocket out of Tumba in the southern part of India. And the space program has come a long way over the last 50 years. India builds its own Earth observation satellites and communication satellites. India also builds two rockets. One of them is the PSLV for launching remote sensing satellites. The other one is the GSLV for launching communication satellites. Recently, India has also started pursuing planetary exploration. We have successfully sent an orbiter to the moon. We made it to Mars in the first attempt. No other country has been able to do that. And we are planning a lander on the moon in the coming year or two. We also have a human space program that's underway. India has tested the crew capsule twice for atmospheric reentry technologies. It's already planning for a residential astronaut training center outside of Bangalore. So literally, India is covering the entire gamut of space exploration and applications.
Okay, so what do you think are some of the biggest challenges that faced the Indian space program?
I have closely worked with the American space program, the European space program, and I'm very familiar with the Japanese space program and the Russian space program. The Indian space program is something I have been associated with growing up because my dad was one of the pioneers of the space program. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of challenges, the Indian space program, when it comes to political support, it has always had unwavering, unstinted support throughout. The budget increases by these days by 25 to 35% every year. Mm-hmm. The reason primarily being that India has effectively demonstrated that space can be leveraged for developmental purposes, for improving the quality of life right here on Earth through its gamut of applications. I think the next challenge for India, the space program itself, is the first 40, 50 odd years, India, after it became a republic, focused on technology independence, how to build things indigenously. I think the next 40, 50 odd years, or even 100, India needs to overhaul its current space policy and have a more extroverted approach where it looks far, looks into the future, and creates a healthy environment for industries to take over the rocket building, the satellite fabrication, and participate in the global space marketplace.
Your latest venture is Earth to Orbit, which is a company based in India. So how would you like to use this company to help develop India's space program?
Yeah, the idea with Earth to Orbit was to lead India's foray into private enterprise. More than 400 companies, big and small, are already supplying components and subsystems for the rockets and the satellites that ISRO builds. ISRO is the name of the Indian Space Agency. What was missing is essentially a world of space startups where young people go out and take risk and approach innovation and enterprise on a totally different footing. I always consider startups to be very different from small businesses, family-run enterprises, in the way they approach business models. They are agile, they're nimble, and they can come up with disruptive technologies in a way that big companies and medium-sized companies cannot. Mm-hmm. So Earth to Orbit has, in the first 5 years of its existence, managed to build a bridge even if it's a tenuous bridge between the US and India. Mm-hmm. So Earth to Orbit was successful in getting the first ever launch agreement signed between a California company, a US company, and the Indian Space Agency, which led to the launch of the Google microsatellite earlier this year in June.
Okay.
And that to me is a diplomatic accomplishment, which only a startup would go out on a limb and try to accomplish. You know, space is not a standalone discipline anymore.
Given your background, you've worked in a lot of different countries and with their space agencies, namely in the US, in Europe, and in Asia. And so how is the approach to space exploration different in these three different places?
That's a very good question, Elizabeth. I think to me, exploration in different geographies has cultural underpinnings. In the US, there's always the frontier mentality because the country was created by mass colonization. So there's this idea of conquering space. Where I come from in Asia, space is not so much a frontier. It's a natural extension of our cosmic everyday reality. In fact, the moon in China and India, we follow the lunar calendar. So the sun, the moon are a part of our everyday lives, and we approach exploration in a more fluid way. So it's that also reflects in the way the government supports the space program. It's not entirely based on return on investment and transactional and business returns. And I think that's a good thing for the world because we end up having different races making it to Moon and Mars, which also has implications for the demographics of exploration.
In the West, people think, yes, space is something to conquer. And you're saying in the East, the philosophy is something quite different. And so do you think that this philosophy has a basis in the culture or the philosophy or the religious beliefs in Asia?
Yes, culture, yes. Not so much in religion or mythology, no. I think it's all about looking at the universe as one grand construct. This is a philosophical approach to life, as opposed to a transactional approach to life.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that the perception in Asia of technology itself differs from the perception in the West?
I can't speak for all of Asia, but I do have exposure to India and Japan, and to some extent China because of friends who live there. I think the way technology is approached in Asia versus, say, Europe or the United States is in the West, innovation has a direct bearing on the economy and progress. So the policy around aerospace or any of the other frontier technologies such as clean tech, nanotech, biotech, is you see a large investment both from the government and private individuals in coming up with, you know, both incremental and disruptive long-term technologies. In Asia, on the other hand, the approach to life in general is kind of very fluid. And for example, India didn't really have policy and roadmaps play a big role or consciously play a big role in the way technology was developed. But I think lately in India, I'm starting to see a fusion in the approach that we've been using for all these years and the way you see things developing in Silicon Valley or the way Europe is promoting centers of excellence. So I think now there's a crossover because we see a lot of collaboration between these geographies. The technology in Asia, to me, becomes sort of a tool to leapfrog and be able to make up for some of the, you know, lack of infrastructure or lack of, even an auto rickshaw driver in India knows more about how to use a cell phone than, say, an engineer in Silicon Valley.
That's interesting. In the United States, especially in places like Silicon Valley or places where there's a lot of innovation and startups, there's this mentality that it's okay to fail. And this might not be as accepted in Asia. And so how do you think this affects how these countries approach new technologies and development of these technologies?
You're absolutely right. In Asia, there is this tremendous sensitivity towards loss of face. So failures are not taken very lightly. However, I think the millennials, those born in the 90s and later, look at failure very differently from their parents' generation. So if you look at the millennials, I think the millennials both in the US and in India, say in Silicon Valley or in Bangalore, have pretty much the same approach. It's okay to fail, and it's okay to even fail spectacularly. You know, it's go on to your next adventure.
Mm-hmm. I see. So in the future, in the very long term, there's a lot of people who are looking forward to potentially making settlements on Mars and potentially making settlements on the moon. And there's been some discussion about if these settlements are made, who should govern them? Are they an extension of a country on Earth, or are they autonomous? So how do you weigh in?
As settlers of distant planets, we need to look at things from a nature's perspective and tread softly. And I say this with a lot of care and caution, because I'm afraid that we will do what we did on other planets in terms of exploiting resources without any care or concern for the environment. Coming back to the second part of your question, I think the way we will settle space is going to be a little similar to the way we've set up base stations in Antarctica. Very many different countries will set up outposts on Moon, on Mars. And they will, by virtue, by nature of, you know, exploration cannot be done alone. So we will collaborate and we will cooperate. And we will explore in our different ways, but we will do it together.
Yeah. So on these future settlements, or even the crew on various space stations, do you think it would benefit people that these crews be international? And should we strive to have a variety of people on board, not just professionally and not just from different countries, but also with various backgrounds, different cultures, different religions, and different belief systems?
Yeah, absolutely. I think racial diversity, cultural diversity is going to be fundamental to how we go out and explore and settle other planets. So not only is it important to have the token Japanese or the token Indian on the International Space Station, I think if you look at the latest movie by Ridley Scott, The Martian, in the plot, there's a time when there's an emergency situation where the Chinese Tiangong station comes in and becomes part of the rescue. So I think the way I look at it is, not only should different races participate in their own independent ways, they should also come to each other's, I mean, not just in rescuing in case of a difficult situation, but also in terms of how we, you know, transfer knowledge, share knowledge, whether it's life support systems or architecture or applications.
Yeah, I think this is a great vision to have an international effort to look at space together and to work at space together, independent of who we are, but more looking at who we are together.
Yeah, if you look at the recent climate change agreement that was signed in Paris and recently ratified by more than 55 countries, where the world is now finally, after decades of wrangling and, you know, political squabbling, we're coming together to say, okay, climate change is a real problem and we are contributing to it, so let's do something about it together. I think the same thing, the same kind of approach is needed in space exploration as well. We need to start with environmental concerns such as space debris and what is our plan and purpose for going out and settling other planets, and do it now rather than later.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that can be done with collaboration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth. It was a pleasure.
This podcast episode almost wraps up our first season of Spark Dialogue Podcasts. I want to thank all of you, my listeners, for making this first season a success and give you the opportunity to talk back. What are you curious about in our scientific world? Or what issues do you see arising in our technical landscape? Reach out at facebook.com/sparkdialogue. Or on Twitter at Spark Dialogue, or email us at podcasts@sparkdialogue.com, and maybe your issue will be discussed in Season 2. This is Elizabeth Fernandez, and as always, thanks for listening.